Hey, Rockstars, it's your host, Lid Sean. Welcome to Recording Studio Rockstars, bringing you into the studio to learn from recording professionals so that you can make your best record and be a rock star of the studio yourself. My guest today is Steve Genowick, three-time Grammy-nominated recording engineer with over 25 years of experience, both as a studio and live recording engineer. Steve has worked primarily out of Capitol Studios in Los Angeles as a staff engineer since 1994. For the last 15 years, Steve has had the great honor of collaborating with 23-time Grammy Award-winning engineer-producer Al Schmidt, working with artists such as Diana Krall, Chris Botti, Gladys Knight, Neil Young, George Benson, Quincy Jones, Burt Bacharach, and Paul McCartney. When not at Capitol, Steve can be found working on any number of major recording studios in Los Angeles or mixing at his home studio. Please welcome Steve Genowick to Recording Studio Rockstars. Steve, are you ready to rock, dude?
I'm ready to rock.
Welcome to the show, man. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's cool. So you already know how to mix in Atmos?
Yeah, I've been mixing music in Atmos for almost 3 years now. I was actually the first guy at Capitol to start doing it.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Comfort of your own home.
Wow, that's really exciting.
Yeah, we have hundreds of songs that we've done in Atmos now. I think there's about 10 or 12 mixers that we have around the world. It's really fun. It's mixing on a whole new level. Like I tell the guys when I'm teaching new guys how to do it, you know, everything you learned about mixing, we've changed all the rules, but we're not going to tell you what they are. You have to figure them out for yourself. There's just so much space, and you know, you use very little EQ and very little compression because you're not having to carve space out to get everything to fit. If something doesn't fit, you just move it to a different part of the room.
That's wild.
It's really cool. Like I make the analogy, you know, as mixers, we've always been trying to get the proverbial, you know, 10 pounds of shit into a 5 pound bag.
Yeah.
Well, now we have a 20 pound bag. So you just move stuff around the room. It's great. So your acoustic guitars can stay nice and big and full. And, you know,
it's almost like it allows you to start mixing in solo now.
Kind of. Yeah. But you don't have to. You just move stuff and go. You know,
that's cool, man.
It's really fun to do. Yeah.
Well, let's circle back and we'll talk more about that in just a moment.
The amount of variety that we run into at Capitol is kind of astonishing, actually.
So that's pretty cool. And I know you've gone on to do lots of big sessions. In fact, you even have something called The Art of Recording a Big Band. Do you want to talk about that a little bit right now while we're on that topic?
When that guy goes out to warm up or when he's tuning the drums, Al's probably getting the drum sound. So there's plenty of times where, you know, they've been, okay, well, you know, session's supposed to start and somebody says, all right, what do you want to hear? We go, we're done. We're fine. Just go. You know, we'll get it on the fly.
And, nice.
You know, take one is a lot of times the take. So we make sure that we're ready for it all the time.
What tips do you have for the rock stars about, you know, how do you do that? How do you sound check without soloing things and without stopping everything and saying, let me just hear the kick drum for a minute?
A lot of it is preparation. So before we get to a session, you know, Al and I have talked about it and we know what's coming and who the musicians are and what the instruments are and where we're going to put them in the room and what mics we're going to use and all that kind of stuff. The morning of the session, we're there hours ahead of time. And we make sure all the mics are working and everything's routed the right way and the headphones are working and all that. So before any musicians show up, we've already done a lot of work. It does help, and we are very spoiled that we have some of the greatest musicians in the world here in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're working with the studio musicians, you know, their instruments always sound good and they know what they're doing. So it's pretty simple to just, you know, just play the drums, you know, and they'll go out there and just start playing. And we just, you know, we've done it so many times and we're using equipment that's familiar to us. In rooms that we've done it in a million times. So it happens pretty quickly. I mean, I can dial in a headphone mix kind of before anybody shows up and at least get it really close. If we're in a room that we haven't worked in before, it may be a little more challenging. It might take 10 minutes instead of 5 minutes.
So some of the speed comes with experience, basically.
A lot of the speed comes with experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we do work very quickly, you know. The musicians will definitely go that fast, you know.
I agree. They're ready to. They've been playing music yesterday, and they're ready to play today.
And a lot of times, you know, if we're doing union dates and stuff, we might only have them for 3 hours. So we got to get everything done, or you know, we have one day. We got to go. I mean, if you watch that video, The Art of Recording the Big Band, we recorded that entire record in one day. I mean, that was 2 3-hour sessions. And we got 12 songs done. They were studio guys. They had never seen those charts before. So they walked in and put them down and played them. I mean, they've played together a lot and they had played Chris's arrangements a lot, but they'd never seen that music before.
Well, so talk a little bit about what it means to record a big band or an orchestra. I mean, what are some of the things that you might set up for a session like that?
You know, when you got big sessions like that, preparation is the key, and making sure that, you know, all the chairs and the headphones are set up beforehand and the mics are hung and they're in the right pattern and all the pads are on or off and that everything's routed to the console and going into tape and coming out of tape. We check polarity on the mics on every single session to make sure that's all correct. So yeah, when we check polarity, we have these little polarity checkers. I think Cricut makes one, and they look like little, you know, stomp boxes, like guitar tuner type size boxes. Mm-hmm. And one has a microphone with a little click that it generates, and the other side has, or it's got, sorry, a speaker that generates a click, and the other side either has a line in or a microphone on it. And we hold the box up in front of the microphone and it clicks away. And in the control room, we have it hooked up to the console, and I see a little green light if the polarity is correct. And if it's wrong, then we figure out why it's wrong.
Do we think about it like this? If a sound is in the live room and it's coming away from the sound source, like the boom of a drum or something, and it's rushing towards that mic, should we understand it that, like, ultimately that should translate to the speaker in the control room moving out towards us at that same moment?
Yes. So a positive energy at the microphone turns into positive energy at the speaker.
Right.
So meaning moving forward, for instance, the speaker moving forward.
And I guess,
and we want all the mics doing it at the same, in the same direction.
Exactly.
So that if you have two mics on a source or, you know, across the room or something, one of them isn't moving positive while the other is moving negative, then you run into phase problems. So we at least start with all the mics in the correct polarity. Now, when you get into phase, that's time and frequency and stuff like that. So that's a different thing. And that you just do by ear. But at least we're starting correct, so to speak. We do that on every session, literally every single session. And you'd be amazed how many times, you know, it could be something as dumb as you find a broken mic cable or a mic cable that's wired backwards. Or sometimes we get a microphone from a man, you know, or, you know, a new mic, and we'll find out that it's pin 2 hot instead of pin 3 hot, something like that. You know, somebody brings in a mic preamp that's wired backwards. And it's not necessarily that it's wrong. It's just wrong for the application we're using it in. It's wrong compared to everything else in the room. Mm-hmm. So we'll correct for it.
Would this apply to recording a rock band in a studio?
Absolutely. Yeah. Process is the same.
So just help us. This is really fascinating. And like trying to imagine how we might want to do something like this in a home studio. If we had like the drums mic'd up, we would take this clicker thing and we'd just sort of go in front of each mic. Or you just set it on the snare drum and each mic would just hear it already? Or do you have to sort of get up close to the mic?
Yeah, we get up close and put it right in front of the microphone.
How often do you feel like you would decide that you like the sound of that in the control room? Do you sometimes want to flip the polarity on some of those mics? Or is flipping usually the act of trying to get them to be all matched anyway?
Once, like if you're talking about a drum kit, once the guy starts playing, then I'll start flipping polarity for sonic reasons. Like, for instance, we have a weird thing in our large ISO booth in Studio A, where it's probably because of the glass in front of it. There's a big glass door so that he can see out. But the overheads seem to always be out of phase with the bass drum in that room. So it's not unusual for us to be flipping the overheads. Now we're talking about phase, because
right.
Now you're talking about. So that's not unusual. It's not unusual. You know, sometimes the toms will sound better if you flip the phase of something, or the kick will sound better. So yeah, I'm always checking phase. If I have two mics on a source, for instance, a snare top and bottom, you're always going to flip the bottom one. You know, good rule of thumb, any two mics that are facing each other are probably going to be out of phase. So you have to flip one of them.
Yeah, we're out of polarity.
But two mics on a guitar amp, I might flip the phase just to make sure that I'm in phase sometimes. Sometimes it's just to check that we're as in phase as we could be, you know. And then if it's not, if I start flipping the phase and nothing's changing, then I know I have a problem and I got to go move one of the microphones.
Interesting. All right. That's a great tip right there. So if you start, if you try to flip the polarity and nothing's changing between the sound, then that means you're out of phase for both versions and you got a problem.
Yeah. Then you're like, you're in between. You're not 180 degrees. You might be like 90 degrees out of phase or something like that. And that's even worse. Then now, I'll go start moving stuff around.
Now, what about between close mics on the drums and the room mics? Can you glean that same kind of information by flipping there? And if you're not hearing it, if the bass, I guess, if the low end isn't clearly bigger on one of the two, then you might say to yourself, you know what, I should move those room mics.
Yeah, I'll go again, flipping the phase, you know, same kind of thing. It's not changing all that much, or I'm, you know, you kind of feel it after a while, like I'm in a weird spot. So it could be, yeah, you move the room mics a foot closer or a foot farther away or something like that. The other thing, especially with drum mics, and this is one of the common things I see when they come in, is that people will reverse the drum mic, like the room mics will be reversed from the the close mics.
Yeah.
Because they're looking at it the wrong way.
Yeah.
You know, to get on my soapbox, one of my pet peeves is labeling stuff left and right. I mean, unless it's a synthesizer, left and right means nothing to me, because when I turn around, it's reversed everything. So I always tell, you know, and I do it and I tell people, label, you know, overhead hat, overhead floor, you know, room hat, room floor, meaning floor tom, or whatever that looks like. You know, if you're dealing with an orchestra or a big band, everything is from the conductor's perspective. So the violins are on the left and the cellos are on the right and the saxophones are on the left, but it's always from the conductor's perspective.
Now, do you sometimes need notes to come with you if you're at a mix stage to make sure that that you understand what the conductor's perspective of the ensemble is? I mean, there are probably some people that mix that up. Maybe they put the strings in a different location or something. How often is that an issue and how does that get solved?
Yeah, I'd like to know if it's something that we're mixing that was recorded by somebody else. I'll probably try to get in touch with whoever recorded it and just say, hey, how was the room set up? How did you guys do it? Is it a traditional orchestra setup, or did you split the violins, or you know, can you send me the setup? Are there pictures from the setup or stuff like that? So then we can glean, especially if it's an orchestral thing, because, you know, an orchestral thing, you want it to sound natural and you want it kind of to sound like it sounded in the room, because that's the point of doing that. So the more we know about what was actually happening in the room, the more we can figure out how we're going to set it up, you know, in our stereo field or Atmos in this case. You know, all this, if I suddenly hear something, you know, like, why does that trumpet sound weird in this microphone? And then you find out, oh, well, that guy was on the other side of the room for this reason. You know, okay, now that makes sense. So let's put him over there. You know, instead of having, you know, a close mic panned to the right, but he was actually in the left side of the room. So he's being picked up on the left room mic and all the mics that were on the left-hand side of the room, but we've now panned him to the right. It's like, no, if you pan him back over where he was actually sitting, it'll sound more natural. So we try to get as much information as we can. You know, a lot of times, you know, just making notations in the comments in a Pro Tools session will give us most of the information we need. If we're recording a session, one thing I always ask is, what happens to this after it leaves here? Like, where is this going? Is it going, you know, and what is it for? Is it a record? Is it a movie? Is it a TV commercial? Is it, you know, is this going to a home studio to be worked on? Is it going to another big studio? Is so that I can make sure that when it leaves my hands, that the next guy has all the information he needs also. You know, sometimes we'll do stuff and we'll do a big band and the producer will go, oh, well, I'm going to do vocals at my house later. Okay, fine. And we give it to him. And 9 times out of 10, you know, I get the call or the email the next day and go, how did you guys have this panned? But the more information we can get and the more information we can give, it just helps everybody.
I almost, this might be a kooky way to do it, but I wonder if you could actually, you know, so you're probably sending off just a folder full of, wave files and somebody's rebuilding the session possibly?
So they're getting Pro Tools sessions. If there's stuff like, you know, a vocal that we did, I might take pictures of the vocal chain, you know, the microphone and the preamp settings and stuff like that. And I might include photos in the files, you know, just put a folder.
A photo's worth 1,000 Pro Tools comments. Isn't that what they say?
Absolutely. And there's little apps you can get that'll, you know, you can insert photos into the Pro Tools session, stuff like that. I try to stay away from some of that stuff because I'm interfacing with a lot of other people. So, you know, if I have some weird app that nobody else has, it's kind of useless to everybody else.
Interesting. So, I haven't even heard about those, but it just occurs to me that you could probably shoot a little video of your setup and then just put that on the video track in Pro Tools as well.
You know, I mean, it's kind of like sometimes when we do movies or pre-records, they'll videotape the conductor and that'll be part of the session so that if anybody has to go back and overdub, they can actually see the conductor. That's not an unusual thing to do. It's not an everyday thing, but it's certainly not, especially if we're not playing the clicks and stuff like that. You know, if you have a choir that has to overdub to that orchestra and it's all out of time, then being able to see the conductor is priceless.
Yeah, but that's kind of genius. I mean, a lot of times in the studio for recording rock music or pop stuff, the drums have probably potentially been edited before you're overdubbing to them. But if you could even just have a video of the drummer playing and that was in the video while you play along to the rest of the overdubs on the track, how genius that would be to see the drummer the entire time you're doing overdubs on a song and even not need a click anymore.
Yeah. But, exactly. And you know, stuff like that used to be difficult, but now it's so simple.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got a video camera.
I know. It's just hard to keep track of things. That's the real hard part.
When you start editing, then it gets weird because now you're editing your video too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, very cool. Well, so let's talk a little bit about some of the mics that help a recording like that sound natural. Are you using things like Decatrees? Are you using stereo mics? Where do you get like the 90% or the 80% of your sound from? And then I want to drop in a specific question and see if you can talk about it too. One of the microphones that I'm really interested in right now and intrigued by is the Vanguard Audio Labs V44S, which is their stereo microphone. And mm-hmm. I know that you've used that one and you've had some pretty good things to say about it.
Yes, absolutely. So first, we'll go to the first part. When we're doing, you know, the big orchestral stuff and big band stuff, we're either using a Decatree for left, center, right, especially if it's a film or a TV project. If it's a record, we might just go with a stereo left and right. And those typically go over the conductor or over the leader of the band, probably about 10 or 12 feet, about 10 feet up pretty much. And those are typically large diaphragm Omni mics. We're big fans of the M50s, the Neumann M50s. The 149s are great. Sometimes we'll get some smaller Omni, small diaphragm condensers. The DPAs are great for that. The Sennheiser MKH-800s are great for that. But typically an Omni mic. And that's going to pick up the room.
And that's a stereo pair of Omni mics?
Either a stereo pair or a Decatree, a left, center, right.
Okay, so if you did a stereo pair of Omni mics, what's the spacing that makes sense? So let's say, I mean, there are a lot of us that might get that opportunity. It's like, hey, can you come record the band, you know, the school band performance or something, like mm-hmm. a first-time opportunity to record something like that?
Yeah, I would start with them 5 or 6 feet apart from each other. So they're usually about 10 or 12 feet in the air. It kind of depends on how big the orchestra is. If we're at like a scoring stage where we have an 80 or 100 piece orchestra, those mics might go up a little higher just because we're trying to get the guys in the back of the room also. But at Capitol, they're typically about 10 feet off the ground and about 5 feet apart and split, you know, like a 45 degree angle, you know, so one's facing left and one's facing right.
Even though it's an Omni,
yeah, absolutely. Because even an Omni mic gets more directional as you get into higher frequencies. So the higher the frequency, the more directional the mic becomes. So there is a bit of a difference between the front of the mic and the back of the mic.
Cool.
Not much, but if you're talking right into it, you probably wouldn't hear that. But when you get it up on an orchestra, you can definitely hear it.
Okay, cool. And then I imagine the 10 feet has a lot to do with also just realizing, well, if you put it low enough, it's going to hear whatever instrument is in the front of the orchestra is going to be much louder. So the 10 feet lets you sort of look down at everything. It's like maybe you just sort of have to imagine yourself taking a photo of the orchestra with an iPhone.
That's what we're doing. We're taking a picture of that orchestra, basically. So, I mean, it's like that with everything. You know, people you know, we get all the time, where do I put this mic? I said, well, find out where the sound's coming from and put a mic at it, you know, aim a microphone at it.
Right.
And orchestra's kind of the same way. It's, you know, where's the sound coming from? So that's why I said, like, if we're in a bigger room with a bigger orchestra, the mics are going to go higher because we got, you know, we may have percussionists, you know, back behind the woodwind section or the brass section. They might be 30, 40, 50 feet away from the microphones, you know, whereas the violin is 4 feet in front of the microphones. So,
but now how does that apply? It seems a little ironic because when you listen to an orchestra, you're out in the audience and you're like, I don't know, it sounds great out here. So right. Why is it that the room mics don't, you know, the recordings mics don't actually just go out to a seat in the audience? Is that because of a good reason?
Well, you could do that if you wanted to, if you're in that kind of a space, if you're in an arena. You know, usually we try to get a little more presence on the orchestra. So we kind of take it as, you know, the conductor's perspective on the orchestra. You know, we do want that depth. So the woodwinds are sitting back behind the violas. We want them to sound like they're back. That's where the depth comes from. So now, along with those room mics, we'll have spot mics on the sections also. So we may have maybe 4 mics over a big violin section and a couple mics over the viola section and a couple mics over the cellos. And, you know, every section may get a couple of mics. And if we have soloists, they'll probably have a mic in front of them. One thing I learned from Al very early on is he's a huge fan of omni mics. So it's not unusual for us in an orchestral or a big band setup to have pretty much every mic in the room in omni. And, you know, we're not so worried about leakage and stuff. It's all one big family at that point. So, you know, typically microphones sound a little bit better in omni. That's kind of their natural state. Most microphones are made directional by doing something, whether it's a physical barrier at the back or there's phase shifting, you know, with dual diaphragms, something like that. So having them in their natural omni state, they actually sound a little bit better. So we go with it. We're never going to control leakage to the point where we can get rid of something if everybody's in the same room recording. So we just embrace it and use it. And that's part of the depth and the how you get that kind of 3D image in a recording.
One of the benefits is because they're in omni, if you want to bring up one section, you're trying to bring up the strings, you're turning up that spot mic a little bit more on the strings. And it is turning up the other stuff that's bleeding into it, the crosstalk from the other sections. However, because it's in omni mode, the crosstalk is not sounding like phasey and it's not doing weird things to what the other mics are picking up of that sound. They're all sort of working together. Again, you've matched the polarity and you've done the little crickety click thing.
Mic. Exactly. It's true. When you get a mic over a section, we have a lot of control in balance and stuff like that. Again, somebody can't say like, can you take the cellos out completely? It's like, no, they're in the room. You're going to, you know, we can't take them out completely. But if somebody has a solo or something like that, we can raise them up. Or if, you know, we have to dig for a line that they didn't play that loud. We have plenty of that control. But like you said, the leakage sounds good. So we use it. The other thing about sessions like that is a lot of the mixing, so to speak, the balancing happens in the room. So the conductor can be your best friend and he can be, you know, he's kind of the first guy that's mixing. So if there's a spot in the piece where the French horns get really loud and they're overpowering everything, we might talk to the conductor and say, hey, you know, at bar 72, that French horn line is really loud. It's killing us. And he'll go, okay, fine. And he'll have the French horns play less. Or, you know, can we bring out the string line in bar 8 or whatever it is? And the conductor can do that on the podium also. And that makes our job a lot easier.
Well, awesome. Well, let's take a break for just a minute and we'll come back in for the jam session. Hey, rock stars, we're back now for the jam session. My guest today is Steve Genowick, joining us from Capitol Studios in Los Angeles. And Steve, if you're ready to jam, I wanted to actually start out by asking you a question about a particular microphone that I have recently become interested in that I heard you had real good things to say about. And it's a company called Vanguard Mics, Vanguard Audio Labs. And so there's a particular mic that Derek makes there called the 44S. It's a stereo microphone. And I wonder if you could maybe tell us a little bit about what your thoughts were with that and how that as a stereo mic is particularly useful in the recording situations you work in.
So I saw that microphone, I saw an ad or a review or something like that. And I'm a big fan of the C24. We have a couple of them at Capitol. I really love that mic. Not only do they sound good, it's easy to get a really good stereo image from them. So I started using them, especially when I was doing like more live broadcast stuff. We used to do a lot of radio broadcasts and stuff, and it's really easy to stick that up over a drum kit. It's, you know, it's basically two C12s. But the great part is that because they're one microphone, because they're perfectly aligned, you can collapse it to mono really great. So I was using it for broadcast stuff, you know, so that when it went on the radio, the drums still sounded good and stuff like that, or orchestral stuff. So anytime I thought that maybe it had to go to mono, I would use the C24. I also use them, believe it or not, I use them a lot on acoustic guitars. Like if it's like a you know, solo acoustic guitar, like a singer-songwriter kind of thing, I'll use a stereo mic on that. Even though it still sounds like it's in the middle, if you get the imaging right, it's a little bit, it's got some depth to it and some space. So I use the C24s quite a bit. You know, it's easy to stick it up over a percussion, a conga or something like that, just because it's one microphone too. It's stand, it's easy.
Yeah, it's one microphone, but it actually has two mics in it, right? It's two different capsules that are on top of each other, mm-hmm, in the microphone.
Right. It's two C12s, basically. I use them in Blumline quite a bit, so two figure eights. I'll use that I've used it on orchestral dates. I've used, you know, string quartet. I've used it on drum kits. I've used it as room mics for drums. I mean, I use them all over the place. So like I said, we have a pair of them. So when I saw the Vanguard was making that style of microphone, the two capsules in one mic, I was kind of intrigued because, you know, C24s are expensive and they're not all in great shape. The ones we have at Capitol are in great shape, but, you know, it's iffy when you get out into the real world, I guess. If you do it at a 90-degree angle, if you leave them in cardioid, you get a pretty good stereo image. If you put them in a bloom line, which is two figure eights, which we talked about before, you actually get a better stereo image.
Yeah.
If you take that mic also and rotate the capsules so that you have one capsule facing forward and the other capsule facing on the sides, then you can do an MS method. And it's,
right,
you know, you're not screwing around with two microphones and trying to get them in phase and all that kind of stuff. So it's great for both. I'm not a huge fan of MS. I don't use it all that much. To me, it always ends up sounding like a phasey mess, but some people are really good at it. It's just not something that I've embraced, but I use the bloom line all the time.
Right. And actually a bloom line, doesn't that actually pick up more of the room and what's behind you, as well as picking up a stereo left-right image of what's in front of the microphone?
Yes, but because of the null points in a figure eight, you actually get a pretty good stereo image. So what's on the left stays on the left and what's on the right stays on the right.
Well, I always wondered, like, what happens if you go behind the microphone? Do you start hearing the left and right image reversed sort of when you're listening back to it? Does that get confusing at all? Or is that like not really an issue?
No, I mean, I guess if you walked behind the microphone, it would. Like if you had a source behind the mic, mm-hmm, then that might get a little weird.
Yeah.
But you know, normally what you're recording is in front of you, so it you know, you don't run into those kind of problems.
Yeah, that makes sense, I guess, right?
Yeah, I guess if you did have, like, if you had, you know, singers all around the microphone or something like that, then it might get weird. I don't know. I try to stay away from that stuff.
Well, so I know you can do 90 degrees, but like, well, you can't really go wider than that, right? So I always wondered if there was a way to get a wider stereo image. You can narrow your XY too, right?
Yeah, I've never gone wider than that. There's been a couple instances where I've made them a little bit narrower because the stereo image was too much.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I don't do that all that often. It's kind of easier just later, which it'll have the same effect. But you could do that. You could make the image more narrow.
Yeah, cool.
By rotating the capsules.
Yeah, cool. I guess that makes sense. And I always feel like an XY is already pretty narrow to begin with. So I'm not really sure why I would want to make it narrower.